Okay, yeah, so I will be talking about viscous hydrodynamics and heavy ion collisions. And I thought it might be a good idea to motivate first why viscous hydrodynamics is of interest to heavy ion collisions. And the way I want to motivate this is by starting some snapshots of an animation of a heavy ion collision by Jeffrey T. Mitchell that I got from the BNL website. So in a heavy ion collision, we think that, first of all, we take this gold nuclei, these heavy ions, and we accelerate them to such high energies that in the laboratory frame, due to Lorentz contraction, they appear not spherical, but actually as pancake-like sheets, if you want to. And a heavy ion collision is then simply, two of those sheets come close to each other. They smash into each other at some point, and we are interested in what is happening after they have collided and formed this quark-gluon plasma that we like to study.
And the nucleons change color.
They do all kinds of things. There are even tachyons in the animation. So. But yeah, so it's just an animation. And I thought it might be a good idea to review some of the terminology I'm going to use in the remainder of the talk. So first of all, the axis where these two nuclei move towards each other is called the longitudinal axis. And if I take the plane where the two nuclei smash into each other, I will call that the transverse plane. And I also wanted to just highlight the prime experimental observables that I will be talking about in the remainder of this talk. So we'll take this transverse plane and then we'll rotate it outwards so that we can see a schematic view of these nuclei head on. So a typical collision will then look something like that. So there will be a certain impact parameter that I will also, so the dependence on the impact parameter, I will also call centrality dependence. And there will be an overlap region where these two nuclei touch. That will be where all the interest is happening, because in an ultra-relativistic heavy ion collisions, these parts of the nuclei that do not participate in the collision, they basically move out at the speed of light and we can forget them for the rest of the discussion. So this central region, this overlap region here, will have a certain overlap area, which I call S. And since it's some sort of elliptic shape, I will also introduce, I will also talk about an eccentricity of this region here.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So this picture assumes that each of the nuclei contributes to every area of the rapidity in the same manner, in some fashion.
Well, no, that's just a very schematic picture of what's happening. So I do not assume that the density in the nuclei is uniform, anything like that. So it's just to give you.
Pardon? No, but well, but this is some kind of picture. Pardon? Yeah, it's transverse plane, but the point is that then this assumes some kind of universality.
No, no, it's just really very schematic picture of the geometric quantities I will be talking about. Also, I wanted to mention, what are the experimental observables that we have? Well, essentially, what we observe far, far out in the detector here is the number of particles with a certain momentum p and with a certain angle with respect to this, well, coordinate frame in the transverse plane. And I should also have added that also one can distinguish certain rapidities, which are in the longitudinal axis here. And for what I will be concerned, I will be talking only at central rapidities, so y equals 0.
Within this geometry, the two nuclei have zero impact parameter. So they really are.
No, this is not zero impact parameter. This just, that's just that. Okay, so as I said, this is what we have at our disposal experimentally. And the two main quantities I will be talking about are the mean of this quantity here, number of particles per unit momentum bin, per unit angular bin, and per unit rapidity at central rapidities. So the mean flow outwards is this quantity here, which I will call radial flow. And if you then look at modifications with respect to this angle, because of symmetry in an ultra-relativistic heavy ion collision, the first angular modulation of this flow will then come in with a cosine 2 phi. And the coefficient is this coefficient v2, which is called the elliptic flow.
Is that not a function of y?
It would also be a function of y, but I said all I will be talking about is central rapidities.
So sorry, because of the experimental setup, these particles apply out only very transverse momentum and not longitudinal
momentum. At central rapidities, they have zero longitudinal momentum, yes. Okay, before I go into the discussion of viscous hydrodynamics, let me give you a bit of history of ideal hydrodynamics. And for that reason, I found it very useful to show this plot here, where we plot the elliptic flow integrated over PT and impact parameter divided by this eccentricity of this elliptic region. And we plot it as a function of number of particles in the central rapidity region, the NDY, which I will refer to as multiplicity also, divided by the area of this overlap region. So why did people do that? Well, it's nice because you can plot different experiments with different collision energies, and they fall on some sort of universal curve. So first of all, they are at very low end of this horizontal axis. You have AGS experiment with about 12 GeV per nucleon collision energies. And those are to the very left because they have the lowest collision energies, which translates to having the lowest energy densities, which translates to have the lower entropy densities. And entropy densities, well, basically a state that has lower entropy means that there are fewer particles that we finally observe in our detector. So if we increase the collision energies, we expect to increase the entropy of your system, and that's why we expect to move on the right on this horizontal axis. Now, these green bands over here are limits from ideal hydrodynamics. And if you look at these very low energy collisions at AGS, the ideal hydrodynamic would predict for this quantity V2 over epsilon about this value up here. The data is down there, so you have a clear discrepancy between.
Let me finish.
You have a clear discrepancy between these experimental data and this ideal hydrodynamic limit, and you can interpret that in some sense by saying, well, at those low energies, we don't really produce a fluid. We produce more like a gas-like state, hadron gas, if you want so. And that has a pretty large viscosity. So viscosity suppresses this quantity V2. So data is down there, and ideal hydrodynamics is there. OK, good.
So how is epsilon for the geometry calculated?
This is Glauber initial conditions.
Which means?
Glauber initial conditions is sort of the standard initial condition where you assume that you take a Wood-Sachsen potential and you just do a Lorentz contraction of that. There are two variants, which one assumes binary collisions, the other just takes participants.
I'm coming back to this original issue, is this picture in transverse plane. If you go, even when you consider mid-rapidity, if you go to the center, of that region, geometric center, transverse plane, then you have, say, five nucleons from one nucleon colliding with five nucleons from another. If you go to the edge of that elliptic region, you have one nucleon from one nucleon colliding with seven from another.
Yeah.
And so how is this accounted for in the number condition?
As I said, I mean, if I go back to that picture, so this is not assuming that you have a uniform density or anything. It's just a very schematic picture of what the geometry of the collision looks like.
Yes, but I mean, now we've got quantitative.
Yes,
yes. A figure which is quantitative.
I will not show a figure which is quantitative.
But you just referred to one of the variants which counts binary collisions,
yes.
Right? That,
yes.
That is just what you were saying, yeah.
Right, but if you look at the collision of deuteron versus with gold, you see a rapidity distribution which is, heavily skewed towards the gold.
Yes.
So is this accounted for in this initial condition?
It is.
Yes.
But the how multiplicity, total number of particles produced depends on that parameter. Mm-hmm. We studied in great detail. And so that curve is reproduced. So in other words, when you collide N nucleons with
nucleons, you mean the hydrodynamics accounts for neutrons?
Not hydrodynamics.
No, it's the initial conditions.
But this plot is nice in the sense that hydrodynamics calculates V2 over epsilon. What you're asking is about epsilon.
Exactly.
How epsilon is calculated. No, hydro calculate
you
response.
Can say for this figure, I can take, you know, just a schematic figure in the transverse plane, and I'm good with it. But then what is used for the hydro in the initial conditions is the important issue. Because that will generate different
details
depending on what you put in.
Yes, I will come to that at the essentially end of my talk.
Okay. So I still wanted to say that this historically was completely wrong. So this blue points, by the way, Pyle calculated from some cascade. It's not an assumption that hadronic gas is a gas. No cross section.
Yes.
Ion
yeah.
Ion.
Yeah.
So. As soon as it goes to hadronic phase, we know how to treat it and it is treated. And so all these black points and blue points were described. And then the question is, when you produce matter above this CO2,
yes, that.
And if you include ideal hydra there, you get a curve which goes right through that point for all these times, long before 0.4. That is just misleading.
Well, so. You're saying that with ideal hydrodynamics you end up down
not
there, or
ideal
okay,
with
good.
Ideal hydrodynamics
yeah, yeah.
In plasma
yes,
phase
yes,
plus it, normal.
Yes.
Phase
yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was not trying to say that this is a mystery down there, but viscosity in a hadron gas is large, and that's why there's well, with ideal hydrodynamics, pure ideal hydrodynamics, you cannot describe this phase down there. All I was trying to say is that, well, you go to higher and higher collision energies. And you observe that this quantity V2 over epsilon goes up. And it goes up until at the highest Rick energies, suddenly you have this data point over here, which for the first time when this data came out was in agreement with a pure ideal hydrodynamic description. So to put it in a nutshell,
other stars are also in agreement with pure hydrodynamic.
Not ideal.
Not ideal for. Pion gas, which everybody knows, is not ideal gas.
Good.
Good. That's my point.
But he's saying if I write it, just history wrong.
I will come to that also.
What is ideal hydrodynamics?
I will come to that. I'm still in the motivation phase. So what I wanted to say is that what do you do if you take this data, you observe agreement with ideal hydrodynamics? Well, you do the only sensible thing to do. You claim victory. Rick serves the perfect fluid. In the words of Uli Heinz, the bulk of the hot and dense matter created at Rick behaves like an almost ideal fluid. An almost ideal fluid? Well, that was just a buzzword I was trying to get to, because almost ideal means that I have to discuss non-idealities, and that brings me to the QCD transfer coefficients, because QCD is the medium we are trying to study here. So, in general, transport coefficients characterize deviations from equilibrium, and typical examples of those are the familiar shear and bulk viscosities, conductivities, diffusion coefficients. And in ideal hydrodynamics, all of those are per definition neglected. So you set them to zero by hand, if you want.
There are vortices, right? This is not lambda flow.
You can have vortices, that's right, but you don't have coupling back of the vortices into the equations of motion, if you want. Good. So what do we expect for these QCD transport coefficients, first of all, in weak coupling? So there was this famous calculation by Peter Arnold, Guy Moore, and Larry Yaffe, who calculated the shear viscosity in perturbation theory at weak coupling for high-temperature gauge theory with NF light fermions. And, well, they calculated this number here in front of that. And if you plug in typical values for QCD at the Rick scale and divide the shear viscosity by the entropy density to make it dimensionless, you'd find values of eta over s for V-coupling QCD, which are on the order of 1 for weak energies. Now, this is to be contrasted if you go to a theory in the strong coupling limit, not QCD, as we heard yesterday, but n equals 4 super young males, where Policastro, Son, and Starnetz calculated the shear viscosity for that system. And again, if you make it dimensionless by dividing by the entropy density in that system, you find this famous ratio 1 over 4 pi, which numerically is about a tenth. So it's much less, about an order of magnitude less than the weak coupling result for eta over s. And you say, OK, I have this weak coupling result, which is about, well, it's 10 times larger than the strong coupling result. The data at RIC seems to be fairly much in agreement with ideal hydrodynamics, which by definition has zero viscosity. Well, you develop or you find the strong coupling plasma. They went on, so Kofton, Son, and Starnitz then went on to conjecture that not only was that the ratio of shear viscosity over entropy density in n equals 4 super young males, but they conjectured that actually all relativistic quantum field theories at finite temperature and zero chemical potential would have a ratio of that quantity which was larger or equal to this 1 over 4 pi, which I said is numerically about 0.08. For real fluids, which you can measure in the laboratory, this viscosity bound is very nicely fulfilled. So in these units, 4 pi, e over s, and h bar, if you look at helium, nitrogen, and water, the viscosity bound is down here in this unit at 1. And all these laboratory fluids have very much higher viscosities. You can also look at cold atoms. So this is a plot by Thomas Schaefer, who extracted a shear viscosity over entropy ratio from data of dispersion relations of this cold atom system. And he found about a ratio of eta over s of about 4 in this unit. So still nicely above the Kofton, Son, and Starnitz bound. So if we go back to our plot here and look at that data point, there are still error bars and everything, but you immediately wonder, if this is ideal hydrodynamics and we know that viscosity decreases the elliptic flow, well, does RIC obey the Kofton, Son, and Starnitz bound, or doesn't it? And maybe even more worrisome, if you just look at the data for a moment and do a naive extrapolation to what LHC energies would give you for this quantity V2 of epsilon, which are far to the right over there, you start to worry, well, is this whole picture consistent? Do we really understand what is going on here? And I would argue that, well, to really do that, you should do a description of your data which really incorporates this viscosity in well, a dynamical fashion. And then you can really make statements about what's going on. So I think some of the interesting questions to ask here are, first of all, what is the value of eta over s at RIC? And if the question is too hard to answer, can we at least answer whether RIC violates the Kofton, Son, and Starnitz bound or not? If we can do that, well, can we also say something about eta over s at the LHC? Well, this brings me to my next point, namely, what I need to do all of these extractions to data, of course, I need a consistent theory of viscous hydrodynamics. So this is coming back to your question, what is ideal hydrodynamics? Ideal hydrodynamics is basically setting up an energy momentum tensor, which for a relativistic system has that form. So it's a T mu, which has energy density plus pressure. U mu is the fluid for velocity. And there's a metric here. And ideal hydrodynamics basically is conservation of this energy momentum tensor. That's ideal hydrodynamics. Viscous hydrodynamics then allows you to encode departures from equilibrium. And if I concentrate on shear viscosity only, I can do that by adding to my ideal energy momentum tensor a part, which I call pi mu, the shear tensor. And this pi mu will contain first order, second order, and so on in spatial gradients of my perturbation data. So you then have a sort of hierarchy of gradients where ideal hydrodynamics basically is just a zeroth order in gradient expansion, and it's the familiar Euler equation, if you want to. First order ingredients will then be the relativistic generalization of what you all have seen at some point, namely the Navier-Stokes equations. And I will also be talking about second order gradient expansion of viscous hydrodynamics. One example of those is, for example, these Müller, Isola, and Stewart theories. And as a remark, I should say that the Navier-Stokes equation, of course, contains ideal hydrodynamics in the limit where you send the viscosity to zero. And in the same fashion, the second order viscous hydrodynamics contain the first order viscous hydrodynamics if you send the second order transport coefficient to zero. Why would I even bother to talk about the second order viscous hydrodynamic theories? Well, if you look at Navier-Stokes theory, so first order hydrodynamics, you have this nice algebraic relation between your shear tensor and the gradient of your fluid velocity. And the proportionality constant is, of course, our familiar shear viscosity. But that theory has some sort of a problem. And to see that problem, you can look at a system that is in equilibrium and do small perturbations around equilibrium in energy density and fluid velocity. You then decompose in Fourier space this fluid velocity into a part that is longitudinal, that's sound, and a part that is transverse to it. And you look at this transverse part, the equation of how this transverse part behaves, and you find, well, this transverse part behaves like a diffusion equation. So you say, okay. Well, the diffusion equation, if I may say so, has a dispersion relation. It's not really propagating, but it's diffusing outwards with a frequency that is proportional to k squared. Well, if you then define some sort of velocity of how this high energy edge diffuses outwards, you find that this velocity, which I will call vt, goes to infinity as you go with your wave number to infinity. So in that sense, this first order Navier-Stokes equation contains modes that basically propagate at speeds that are bigger than the speed of light. And that's a problem because you want to have a causal theory.
If you apply it outside of the region where it should be valid.
Yes. So of course I have to say that these modes are clearly the ones that are the large K modes, and those are actually really outside the regime of hydrodynamics, which I tried to describe. So in principle, it's not a problem, but it's a problem in practice because you want to really solve the theory. So you want to do natural science with it, which means you want to get numbers out. And to get numbers out for hydrodynamics or fluid dynamics in general, you typically have to do numerics. And it turns out that these problematic modes then really screw up your numerics badly. So you have to do something about it. One way to do it is, for example, to regulate the theory by hand, doing a first-order theory and just throwing out the modes that disturb you. But I want to use a sort of second approach where I would look at...
That obviously breaks the relativistic
approach. It definitely is... Well, I would argue that the better thing to do is to look at these second-order gradients because it turns out that those will regulate this theory by itself.
This first thing also introduces dissipation by hand, right? So you definitely
do something that, well, is in some sense not very appropriate. So you can probably set this up to...
Second-order is also dissipation.
But second-order non-relativistic is...
So first of all, in non-relativistic system, first order doesn't have a problem because the mass is regulated.
But second order?
I'm not aware of that. So as I said also, I mean, the second order goes to the first order in the limit where you put the second order coefficients to zero. So it shouldn't behave more badly than the first order.
Well, I mean, this is the same problem as usually when your gradients are low and so on, it's okay. But the point is that principally, the equations are unstable, the second order. This is what I remember from school, Barnett's equation.
Oh, this is not really Barnett's equation.
Okay.
This is something in the same, well, you can compare it in order for gradient expansion, but it's not the same. So it's a little different.
Okay.
But also the second order equations you regulate.
Yes.
Dissipation.
But that's a different issue. That's then a numerical dissipation that you ultimately have to deal with. But you can approach a continuum limit.
Okay.
Whereas in the first order theory, you cannot approach a continuum. That's the main difference.
So by going to second order, you're just introducing the next order in derivative, the
yes.
derivative expansion.
Yes.
So, but that will only be valid up to some typical k.
Yes.
So why don't you have problems also when you go to second order at some point?
In principle, I could have, but it turns out that the structure of the equation is such that I don't have. So it's, if you want, so a regulation by accident. It could have not worked out.
And that doesn't depend on the specific solution you're looking at?
No.
But you don't have second order time derivative?
You do have only first order time derivative. Well, it depends on which quantity you're looking at. So if you look at fluid velocity, you have second order time derivatives. Yeah.
I mean, you're constructing an effective theory that's only valid on sufficiently long scales.
Yes.
You can have different forms of such an effective theory that are equally valid within their domain of validity. Some of those effective theories can essentially be super renormalizable. That you can ignore that you don't have to regulate it by hand and its short distance behavior is nice. Other effective theories, I mean, we're used to that you need to stick in regulators. So you're just finding a form of an effective theory that happens to be have nice short distance
yes,
behavior.
Yes, exactly. That's the point.
But given that you have higher time derivatives,
yeah.
doesn't that change the nature of the initial value problem?
Well, it changes the nature in the UV. But that doesn't disturb me because
you said this has a continuum limit.
Yes, it has.
Forget about the cutoff.
Yes, but you're still doing hydrodynamics. So I'm still concerned about the low or the long wavelength limit of my theory. And
but your whole point was you had a consistent.
Yes. 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 It's
but
it doesn't.
With higher derivative.
Twice as much as initial data.
Right.
Yes.
So how do isn't there don't you have to add some other principle to fix, cut the initial data in half?
So I have to specify more initial data, that's right. And
what specifies that?
Basically, you have to put in some physics input, like for the first order theory. So already for ideal hydrodynamics, you have to put in physics to really specify your boundary conditions.
Right.
And you have to put in more physics.
In effect, of double the degrees of freedom.
That's still done also. If you have more and more derivative, you have distortion curve with more complicated polynomial, and you get fake poles.
Right.
Coefficients of this moves to zero.
Density contrast is related to the continuity equation.
Come again.
So the density contrast will have its own equation of motion. This one will be second order in time, so you can compute from there in
Skinner
sum. So the principle of the information from the velocity and information from the density should be supplied.
Well, as I tried to say, so you always have to supply these initial conditions anyways. You have to supply more for the second order than for the first order for ideal hydrodynamics. But for example, the speed of sound you cannot compute within hydrodynamics. You have to put in from another theory, the underlying quantum field theory, for example. You cannot compute it within hydrogen.
If you have second order gradients, your speed of sound will depend on k equations.
The speed of sound will not depend on k, no. But
dissipation.
The dissipation will depend on k.
Can we let Paul at least show us
the
equations, and then we can pin them down in great detail later?
Exactly.
Yes,
to guess the problem.
So that already, well, I still wanted to review very briefly, again, some theory that is now about 30 years old, Müller, Isser, and Stewart. They come up with a phenomenological approach, if you want, so to cure this apparent r-causal behavior of the Navier-Stokes equation. And the way they did is they wrote down a term. They added a term to this equation, which had a time derivative of your shear tensor. So in that respect, it was second order. It had a second order coefficient, which is called a relaxation time. And basically, the rest of the equation more or less stays the same. There are some extra terms, but, well, the essential part is this one. And if you then have this differential equation for your shear tensor pi min u, you can go through the same exercise at calculating this speed with which these transverse perturbations diffuse outwards. And well, lo and behold, you find this result here, that if you plug in values for the recoupling or the relaxation time in recoupling QCD and the shear viscosity in recoupling QCD, you find that this velocity is now smaller than the speed of light. So in that sense, this effective theory doesn't have this problem of this superluminal propagation anymore.
So I understand the motivation for adding just this term, but in order to be consistent, shouldn't you add all possible terms with the same number of derivatives?
Yes, you should, and that's what we did. But it hasn't been done until last year, strangely enough. Yeah. So this is just precisely the point. So this term is not the only one of second order that you can add. You get different terms, different coefficients of these terms, whether you take a Boltzmann equation and say, this is my V-coupling microscopic theory, and I derive hydrodynamics out of that. Or if you take, for example, a Heisenberg operator and you try some coarse graining, you get different terms, different coefficients. So with the advent gauge gravity duality, that's what I was looking for. You can now look at what would be, or you can now ask the question, what would be the equation or the form of the equation of this Müller-Isser-Stewart theory if you try to match it to, for example, strongly coupled N equals 4 superyoungmills. Specifically, would this relaxation time in N equals 4 superyoungmills still be such that, well, you still get this nice property that the diffusion modes have, smaller than speeds of propagation smaller than the speed of light? And another question which was asked by Lublinsky and Edward Churyak here was to say that, well, these second order coefficients, they can also be quantitatively important. They can look as if they sort of behave like viscosity, if you want so, because in essence, we only have data and we cannot really at first glance say which part of this data is due to first order transport coefficient and which part is due to second order and so on. So it could also have quantitative importance. Part of that we recently clarified by looking at the specific theory, namely we looked at the hydrodynamics of conformal fluids. So fluids where if you rescale your energy or your metric tensor, the energy momentum tensor behaves in a specific form. Obviously, if you rescale your metric, this form is trivially satisfied for ideal hydrodynamics because there are no derivatives in ideal hydrodynamics. So you can just pull it through. It's also okay for the Navier-Stokes equation because this projection operator, which I denote by the brackets and didn't really talk about, has this nice property that the derivatives of your conformal weight just cancel out and you can still pull out this conformal factor. Now, it turns out that for this term in the Isser-Stewart equation that I was highlighting, this is not okay. So the derivatives of your conformal weight in that term do not cancel. And you can immediately ask, what do I have to add to that to make it conformally invariant?
The conformal weight of the stress tensor, 4 or 8 in those units, the dimension 4. I don't understand the 6.
No, so you have the 2 from the metric and temperature scales like with 1 power in e to the omega. So you have 4 powers from the temperature and 2 from that, and that gives you 6.
So this is very different from the zero temperature stress tensor.
Yes. But I can show you. So there's a definite way of finding out which power it is. You can
G has Z in NADS. So whether it's the upper indices or lower indices, for example, that's already making a difference.
Yeah, but normally
So you might immediately say, well, this is a conformal fluid. Why would I care about conformal fluids in the first place? QCD, well, at least at some point, will probably not be conformal. But I would argue that even though not all theories are conformal, viscous hydrodynamics theory should at least be able to describe conformal fluids. So in that sense, it's sort of the minimal requirement of a conformal, for viscous hydrodynamic theory to be able to describe conformal fluids. And in that sense, one can just sit down and classify all allowed terms to second-order ingredients in the conformal setting. And it turns out that to second order, there are just five of those. If you put them all together, this is what comes out. In d dimensions, the equation for your pi mu looks...
Conformal, how many?
Pardon me?
And if not conformal, how many more structures?
More.
How many are killed?
But, so if you just look at shear viscosity, I would argue that you only have to look at those that are conformally allowed.
Why?
Because essentially the non-conformality is the source of bulk viscosity rather than shear viscosity. So for shear viscosity, you're fine if you're looking at conformally.
If you're looking at systems where for some other reason you're already convinced that neglecting bulk viscosity is a good idea.
Yeah.
Then you're saying you're already convinced that you're close to describing a conformal fluid.
Yeah. Or for example, if you want to look at specifically n equals 4 superambies, which we know is a conformal fluid anyways.
That would be fine.
So, I just wanted to highlight the point that there are one of these terms that are now allowed has this form here where you have a derivative of your shear tensor again, and it comes with a coefficient that you can again describe as this relaxation time. But there are actually four others. One of them, this kappa here, which comes in with the Riemann and the Ricci tensor, and three others which involve self-coupling of the shear tensor, coupling to vorticity, and vorticity self-coupling. But yeah, that's just details if you want to. And
Are we doing second-order derivatives
that
are still linear in perturbations, or we're now doing non-linear in perturbations?
Well, these terms are nonlinear in, for example, derivatives of fluid velocity, because you have a derivative of fluid velocity here and there, but they're second order in derivatives. They're all terms to second order derivatives, including nonlinearities.
Okay, but if I'm in flat space, I ignore the second line.
Yes.
And if I'm looking at small perturbations, I ignore the third
you
line.
You ignore this third line, yes. Yes. So you're back to essentially this term here. But you have, for example, that term there depends on the geometric setting. But you're completely right. So for flat space, this complicated equation boils down to something simpler again. But nevertheless, I argue that for at least for the general theory in curved space, this is what you have to deal with. Mm-hmm.
So for the shear viscosity, there's a Kubo relation related to something. Like
yeah.
So for the other coefficients?
Yes, there would also be one, more general. Good. So what I was just telling you is that the more general theory has five of these second order transport coefficients that, whereas the Müller-Isser-Stewart theory only has one of them, namely this relaxation time here. So specifically, the Müller-Isser-Stewart theory does not allow for this non-vanishing coefficient kappa that comes with these curvature terms. You can track this down and find that the reason why Müller-Isser-Stewart theory does not allow for this kappa coefficient is due to the fact that you can set it up as a coarse-grained Boltzmann equation. Boltzmann equation is itself only a first-order gradient expansion of our underlying quantum field theory, so it's not too surprising that at second order things don't match up in some sense. You can then work out what the coefficient is for n equals 4 superambies in the strongly coupled limit, and you find, there's a non-zero coefficient. So obviously you have to conclude that Müller-Isser-Stewart theory cannot be the correct viscous hydrodynamic theory, at least in a general setting.
So
yes?
So kappa was the coefficient of the curvature theory?
Yes.
So you're doing n equals 4 on flat space or in the sphere? Why would I care about those curvature terms if I'm doing n equals 4 fluid dynamics?
Well, you would care because you want to match a viscous hydrodynamic effective theory to a more general microscopic framework. For example, strongly coupled English 4 superambles, which is accessible via ADS-CFT correspondence.
Yeah, but so one equals for the flat space.
Yes, but still you want to match the theory somehow. And if the structure of the effective theory doesn't match to the structure of your underlying, gauge theory, then you have a problem. Even though if you don't apply it in flat space.
If you don't apply fiber in the bulk.
My question is, if you take
you can measure kappa even if you're not in flat space.
Exactly.
Even
yeah, but I'm just saying, but in the application I have in mind is understanding either
yes.
flat space, I don't need to worry about what kappa is.
Right. Right.
So
right.
So when you say that Muller is assuming we have zero for kappa
yeah.
from the Boltzmann equation, and it's doing it explicitly in curve space.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, otherwise.
Otherwise,
otherwise it's trivial. So the only point I want to make is that you have to look at this more general theory, because if you try to also calculate these other coefficients, the one that matter in flat space, you have to know about, in some sense, the fact of the structure of the theory and explicitly this kappa coefficient. So let me tell you a little bit more precisely what I mean by that. You can first of all look at what these values of these coefficients would be in strongly coupled n equals 4. And you find that, this relaxation time, some value for that. But this value is interesting in the sense that if you look then at this transverse diffusion velocity that I was alluding to previously, you still find this nice property that is smaller than 1. You still have a theory that does not have this superluminal propagating modes. And just to highlight one thing, if you, for example, then look at what the other coefficients would be like, for example, this lambda 1, I use a piece of work by Helle and Yannick, who look at, for example, a solution of hydrodynamics, or rather I should say of n equals 4 superambles, in a setting where I have Bjorken expansion. So even though space is flat in that setting, I have to take into account this more general structure of my equations there. And if I don't do it in the more general theory, I would get a different value for these coefficients, which then couple back to my relaxation time. So what I'm trying to say is that in the more general theory, if you match it to, for example, strongly coupled n equals 4 superambles, you have to have this more general theory in order to get a consistent description of, the hydrodynamic behavior of strongly coupled n equals 4 to nonlinear orders in gradients. Also, I should briefly add that these coefficients were confirmed by these gentlemen here in a paper that appeared also last December, and they calculated the remaining two coefficients which have those values there. Okay, so all I wanted to say is that with all these formal developments, we now have a viscous hydrodynamic theory that basically allows us to describe not only weakly coupled plasmas, but also strongly coupled plasmas. And the idea is now.
And if you compare with Benoit et al.,
yeah.
they also constrain the general form.
Yes, yes.
And it turns out to be the same constraints. There are no extra parameters.
There are no extra parameters. No, it's the same constraint, and they basically come up with the same structure as we are.
Yeah, they explicitly do ADS-CFT, so
yes.
they're outside the framework.
Right. But the fact that they come up with the same structure.
Yes. Yes.
Any reason why not the three should be zero? Same solution?
I frankly don't know. Might be. It was the self-coupling of vorticity. Self-coupling of vorticity.
Vortices interacting
yes.
with
yes.
So vortices are sort of BPS.
I don't know.
What? What is the other one?
Okay.
So what you had?
Lambda three was the coupling of vorticity to vorticity, and there's another one where vorticity couples to the shear tensor, and that's non-zero.
And the one is vorticity.
No, lambda one is self-coupling of the shear tensor to itself. Then you have a coupling of the shear tensor to vorticity, and then you have a vorticity self-coupling. And that one is the one that turns out to be zero. Okay. Yes, I basically said that. I should also still remind you that what you're doing is still hydrodynamics. So it is sort of, well, implied that if you take this too far from equilibrium, then obviously even the second order theory will break down. And that is also something that is a little bit in conflict with Müller-Israel-Stewart theory, because they were hoping to construct a theory that is valid, well, at least a little bit beyond the original hydrodynamic regime. But yeah, so this is just a sort of more restricted applicability of hydrodynamics, but it's hydrodynamics, so yeah, I would say it's okay. Okay, having that, we can now take this viscous hydrodynamic theory and try to really extract E to S from data. Before I really jump into the data and show you what's going on there, I wanted to reiterate that, well, hydrodynamics obviously are about differential equations, and you need to supply initial data or boundary conditions if you want to actually make sense of that. So specifically for RIC, or describing heavy ion collisions, things include like the time where you actually start your hydrodynamic evolution, the form of the initial energy density distribution. There are two models. The main one is this Glauber initial conditions, which I said was just essentially integrating up a Wood-Sachsen potential. There is a slightly more exotic initial condition, which is called the Kolodans condensate. I will give you what the main details for heavy ion collisions are between these two initial conditions. Then you have to supply an equation of state from QCD, which will fix you the speed of sound that you have in your simulation. And I would argue that obviously knowledge about that has to come eventually from lattice gauge theory. And finally, you have to proceed to supply some prescription of how you convert hydrodynamics degrees of freedom into actual particles. And I think at the moment there is no real serious alternative to this Cooper-Frye prescription in one form or the other. So what I wanted to say is there's actually much more to RIC hydro than just fluid dynamics. It's not just solving the equations, but it's putting in all these other models, if you want, so to really get a result. So first of all, are we actually allowed to use hydrodynamics for RIC? Larry already commented on that yesterday and answered this question by yes. I come to the same conclusion somewhat independently by saying that I take my simulation, I run a typical RIC heavy ion collision by saying I have a certain impact parameter which has a certain eccentricity. This is this quantity here. And then I look at how this momentum eccentricity, or the V2, evolves as a function of time. For ideal hydrodynamics, which is this dashed curve here, for 1 over 4 pi, shear viscosity of entropy density, which are these three curves here, and for 2 times, well, 2 or 1 over 2 pi, shear viscosity of entropy density. And then I take my second order transport coefficient, this relaxation time, and I put it to three different values, where the lower one essentially corresponds to the n equals 4 super Young-Mills value, and the higher one corresponds to Boltzmann equation. And those are these three curves here. And you see the dependence of the Betul coefficient is not very large. It's actually quite small if I choose these different values of this relaxation time. And that's a good thing in sense, because it means that the second order transport terms do not alter my equations in a big fashion. So I have a very small dependence on them. So it looks like my hydrodynamic effective theory is converging in the sense that second order gradients are much smaller in their extent on the observables than first order transport coefficients like shear viscosity. So I should also add that Dusling and Tini come to sort of a similar conclusion by looking at their first order hydroformalism, and they argue that hydro should be reliable up to shear viscosity over entropy densities of about 0.3, which is in the same ballpark. Heinz and Song do not really agree with that, but they started out with a hydro equation that doesn't respect conformal symmetry, so they are missing some terms. So they still have some dependence of this second order transport coefficient. But I would say that even though consensus has not emerged on this subject yet, I think there's a fair chance that one can actually apply hydrodynamics at RIC, so that it really makes sense to talk about transport coefficients there.
When you say they miss something according to conformal symmetry, you don't have conformal symmetry anyways, right?
Well, so what I mean is that they if you take this theory which obeys conformal symmetries, the terms have a certain structure. And they don't use that structure, they sort of take essentially Müller-Isher Stewart theory.
Except they don't include his five terms. And if you restrict to non-conformal, then you have more terms. They don't tell us how many more terms.
Well, it's not even that they don't use the five terms, they only use parts of those five terms. So they use, for example, they drop half of a term that otherwise in combination would be conformally invariant. They drop half of it, and that explains why. Or you can explicitly check that if you drop half of this term, then you get a much bigger dependence of the second order transport coefficient.
So the first line of these conclusions is just valid when you take these five?
Yes. They're actually less if you go to flat space, as we already said. But in principle, yes.
The real point is that at your earliest times where you have the largest gradients, that those gradients are still small enough that the whole framework doesn't fall apart.
Yes.
But that surely now depends on what you actually assumed for those initial
conditions. Yes, yes.
And the curves you just showed us were for one particular choice with, I presume, nice, smooth initial energy density.
Yes, that's right.
Well, what's the sensitivity there?
Yes, so.
And he always, of course, used little s small. That is the crucial thing.
Yes.
If it would be one, everything would be lost.
And it should, in fact, be time dependent.
Yes, both are, of course, true. So what I assume for the initial conditions are the one that are typically assumed if you do hydrodynamics at RIC. Namely, you say that you have a starting time of hydrodynamics which is on the order of 1 Fermi over C. It's not 0.1 Fermi, it's not 10 Fermi, it's about 1 Fermi, maybe half, maybe 2. Those.
Well.
I have checked.
0.7, 0.8.
Well, 0.5 is good. So 0.5 doesn't change the dependence on the second order. If you put 0.1 or 0.01, then maybe we have a different story. But what I'm arguing is that for typical quantities which are seemingly in the right ballpark, this dependence on the second order transport coefficient is small.
That's all I can say. The dependence on eta, if you do the plot back, can you do that?
Sure.
So there's a factor of two effect from including eta. So from ideal, sometimes to first order
has
a 100% effect, but then going to second order, it's minute.
Yes. Yes, that's my main point.
Rapidly converging.
But it is only curly time, then they're kind of more similar.
Yes.
The
and
final answer would be more similar.
Yeah, and that's also clear because the gradients are largest at very early times, so you expect larger differences at the early times.
Why don't these problems with the first order hydro appear here just so they're a little bit low?
Because I was just arguing if I use the second order theory, I don't have this problem with the superluminal propagation because the dispersion relation turns out to be such that I don't have these modes.
Sure, in a second order. But here the first order actually is very well with single order.
That's all second order. It's all second order. It's only that here I changed the first order coefficient.
This is zero and second.
Do I understand it right that if you include your second order coefficient and go to, say, flat space, momentum, dispersion curve equation, you solve your polynomial for dispersion curves, and then suddenly if you have the second order terms, all your poles not have positive imaginary part or something.
Well, you can understand it in that way, that the first order formalism, the Navier-Stokes equation, has an algebraic relationship between your gradient of velocity and the shear tensor, which means that if you have a perfect equilibrium system and I perturb my fluid velocity field at one point, then instantaneously it's felt everywhere else. And that I cure by going to second order. That's the physics.
But there are the spurious poles of dispersion curves, new poles, and they're all damped. Yes. None of them goes.
Or is charged with initial conditions where those don't shear.
Initial condition would appear. Because the instability.
So do you have the dispersion relations for the linearized second order equation?
I haven't
because usually
had a slide here, so it's not easy. It's a complicated formula.
Right. Well, he obviously has to kill these extra modes.
But
they may not be excited.
If you look at sound and see what are the sounding modes.
But they may not be excited.
Yeah, for sound,
You always excite everything.
A little bit, yeah, but maybe not enough.
I should emphasize that for sound, there is not a problem here. So for sound, you don't have any superluminal propagation. It's only for the diffusive mode that you really get this problem.
You look for all modes, and all of them should be.
Yes, possible. Yes, yes. That's the idea.
Well, the second order terms you're including are only those allowed by conformal effect.
Yeah.
So that's, of course, fine for any goes for like the QCD. Do we know that's the.
Well, so.
And if you were to include one, say, that's forbidden by conformal invariance, the result would not be sensitive to the
question. So it's clear that for QCD, eventually, one also should include terms that break conformal invariance. And I would argue that those basically are represented by effects from Boole viscosity, which I explicitly ignore, and I think everybody else so far has ignored this. There's definitely an issue here that eventually this should be included.
But we know the bulk viscosity is much, much smaller than the shear viscosity at asymptotically high temperatures, and the lattice estimates, whose reliability we can discuss, also suggest that even at temperatures that are more relevant to Rick, the same statement is true. That's not exactly a
case also at very close proximity to the phase transition. Okay, you won't expect the Boole viscosity.
Sufficiently close, you expect it to be to grow significantly.
Yeah. Okay, so let me speed up a little bit. So I'm now at the point of showing how you can actually extract information from data here, and I should highlight how this is done usually. So as I said, you have this big freedom in choosing your initial conditions and whatnot, and there basically you are forced to use some subset of data to fix those initial conditions. Otherwise, you can produce anything essentially. And a more or less sensible way to do this is you use experimental data on how the number of particles, the multiplicity, depends on your impact parameter or the centrality. You use that to fix your overall normalization of your energy density. Then you use the data on the mean PT or the radial slow to fix the starting time of hydrodynamics and the stopping time, if you want so. And once you have done that, if you choose a particular form of the energy density, not the normalization, that you have fixed already, but a particular form of the energy density, for example, Glauber or Kolleger's condensate, what you get out for the elliptic flow coefficient is a prediction in that model. Of course, it's a post-prediction because you want to compare it to data, but for LHC, it would be a prediction. So let's do that. First of all, let's look at the multiplicity, where I assume this Glauber model here. This is data from Phoenix. And these three different color curves are hydrodynamics for ideal hydrodynamics, 1 over 4 pi viscosity and 1 over 2 pi viscosity. And I want you to concentrate mostly on these kaons here. There's a very rough, I would say it's a sensible agreement between these hydrodynamic curves and the data. So the overall normalization is fixed then by that.
And we just ignore pions?
Well, so there's a certain issue here. So the pions are quite light particles. So they have a strong Bose enhancement at low PT. And I could have encoded that in my code, but it's a lot of work to encode Bose Einstein statistics. It's much easier to write a code that includes only Boltzmann statistics. So that discrepancy is to a large part due to my laziness, if you want. So if I would encode that and write another 1,000 lines of code.
Specifically handling the freeze out.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's not the Bose-Einstein, pions appear from the decay of all other particles.
Those are included.
So if you don't want to go into that.
Those are included. The decays are included.
What about
the protons? There's another issue. What I assume is zero chemical potential. So that I cannot distinguish between protons and antiprotons. And that necessarily means that I have to fail into getting these proton ratios right in some sense. They are annihilate in my simulation. I have no way of distinguishing between.
What are those two sets of?
Those are protons and antiprotons.
By the way, the fact that they are so close shows that chemical potential is basically zero.
Yeah, but still. Sorry.
And the fact that they're systematically on the same side of hydro, then I still don't quite understand. I mean, failing to include the chemical potential, you'd think you'd underpredict one and overpredict the other.
Well, not necessarily. If I have zero chemical potential, they can also annihilate in my hydro simulation, and I get less of both, if you want.
Yeah. Well, the normalization proton is
real light.
The fact that he got normalization protons wrong means that it has one common result.
Well, yes, that's what is typically. What is typically done is that you go to chemical non-equilibrium, you include chemical potential, you freeze out mesons at another scale as protons. So there's all kind of more technology to that. That can probably be fixed eventually. But it's more work, if you want.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, can you explain this figure? Because naively one would expect that more viscosity, more entropy, more pions.
Yes.
But is there this?
Yes, that's true. That's true. You can calculate how much more entropy you get. And I correct for that by going to slightly smaller initial energy densities. So I correct for the extra increase in entropy density. So that's part of this fixing of my initial conditions. So they should be there because I put them there by hand.
Your ideal hydro line is such that you checked for dissipative terms that you get by putting it on lattice, and it's really ideal.
My numerical viscosity seems to be pretty low. I can check that.
Much lower than what you put in by the other.
Yes, yes. So my entropy production is dominated by the physical viscosity, and I can check how much is generated there. And that's what I correct for.
How much is it?
The figure is about 3/4 of eta over s in percent. So if eta over s would be 1, I would produce 70% more entropy. If eta over s is 0.1, well, it's not very much. It's only on the order of a few percent. Okay, then let's look at the radial flow. So it's the same story. I have data here with error bars, and I do that for three different viscosities. Again, ideal 1 over 4 pi and 2 over 4 pi. And it turns out that by changing my overall normalization, the energy density is roughly enough to bring also those curves within agreement of the data error bars. So I don't have to do more tuning around of my initial final conditions. I basically take that and get reasonable agreement with data on that.
Did you ever play with some time-dependent eta over s?
No, I didn't. No.
Just to see whether it's a huge effect.
No, but it doesn't depend.
So what? First of all, of course, eta over s is probably time dependent in the plasma that goes over a wide range of temperatures, freeze out, and so on. But what I try to fix first is the mean value of the whole system evolution. If you cannot get that, then encoding time dependencies bring another parameters, maybe 1, 2, and so on, which you cannot really constrain out of it. So at the moment, I'm trying to fix only what is the mean value through the whole system evolution. Okay, so once you've fixed those, you can then look at what you get for the elliptic flow, V2. So here's data from Phobos, including 90% confidence level systematic errors. And again, this light green line here is ideal hydrodynamics. The red curve is 1 over 4 pi viscosity. And the blue curve is 1 over 2 pi. And what I take away from this plot is that the mean of shear viscosity over entropy density from the data is constrained such that it should be less or on the, well, not much more than this 0.16. That's all I can extract from this plot. If you then go to star data on the minimum bias V2, which is, if you want, so orthogonal in parameter space, so this is a function of PT now, this is the data, but only with statistical error bars. There are no systematic error bars available at the moment. Again, you have ideal hydrodynamics here, 1 over 4 pi, 1 over 2 pi. And you see, well, even with 1 over 4 pi, so this minimal viscosity, you clearly are below what you expect from the data. If you want to put a number for the data would give you, you can look at this line here, which has a ratio shear viscosity over entropy density of about 0.03, so which is 1 over 8 pi, roughly. So there seems to be some issue here that at least if you take these sort of initial conditions, Rick really seems to tell you, well, even the mean value of viscosity is, well, maybe below what you would expect from the Kofton-Sonne starinets.
Do you understand the saturation of high PT?
Well, essentially, so hydro is a low PT effective theory. At some point, it has to break down at some PT. And, it turns out to be happening earlier for ideal hydrodynamics than for viscous hydrodynamics, which is expected. But yeah, so at about 2.53 GV, the data show us a saturation of elliptic flow, whereas in hydrodynamics, if you use essentially a power law or Taylor expansion of PT, it breaks down at some point.
Yeah. You should appreciate the beauty of this thing, that normally you think that some part of particles show some hydro, and then there are tails and things like this. The fact that it goes and agrees up to 2 GeV, yes, what I want to say is the absolute spectrum falls by about 2.5 orders of magnitude, which means 90-something percent of particles are described. It's like 0.5% of particles are somewhere in the tail, which hydro does not describe,
yeah.
Which is very strange.
Yes, and it also
a system of only a few hundred particles.
And it also compares with what Larry said yesterday, that you can use linearized hydrodynamics up to temperatures or up to momenta of order T, with about this factor of 1.5 around.
You find system.
But yeah, so temperatures here are on the order of 200 MeV, which is down there, right? And it's really remarkable that you get some sort of agreement up to, let's say, 10 times the temperature.
And you see this breakdown in other quantities
at
similar? Yes. Yes.
Yes.
You see it also in the radius law and so on.
Everything breaks down around the.
So let me just say that independently, Song and Heinz came also to this conclusion that there is a problem concerning the Kofton-Sonne starinets bound and Rick data. They looked at copper-copper. This is the ideal hydrodynamic curve that they produced. These two curves are 1 over 4 pi viscosity with two different values of this relaxation time. Note the strong dependence here, the factor of 2. And they argue that this is a 50% drop in elliptic flow, essentially, which cannot be brought into agreement with data from Rick.
Can I just ask you, how seriously would you take this? I mean, the statistical error can't possibly dominate this, right? I mean, the systematic error, I would think, is much bigger.
Yes, I agree that systematic experimental error would be vital to settle this issue. But I have another thing that I wanted to highlight before I finish, namely, if you change the initial conditions from Glauber to Kolar-Glauss condensate. So the thing is that this eccentricity here, here I plot this eccentricity for the global model, which is the curve below, as a function of, well, this is essentially impact parameter. And this is what you get from this Kolar-Glauss condensate model. And you see that, well, this Kolar-Glauss condensate model is an initial condition such that you get a higher eccentricity for the same impact parameter. And then you can ask what would be the resulting curve if you put that into my hydro and get out the curve for elliptic flow. This is how it looks like. So this is work done by a PhD student at the University of Washington, Matt Lusum. And so you have the corresponding plot here. I just kept the ideal hydrodynamic line from Glauber and the 1 over 4 pi from Glauber. And these two curves are ideal hydrodynamic for Kolar-Glauss condensate. And the dashed line is Kolar-Glauss condensate with viscosity 1 over 4 pi. And lo and behold, you see you are now above the data by some small margin. So all I wanted to say is that if it turns out that this Kolar-Glauss condensate condition is the real initial condition, there's still a fair chance that the Kofton-Sonne starinets bound is nicely in agreement with data. But of course, it would be very interesting to have systematic error bars from data like this data bars from Phobos here. This is just to highlight that also the these are very bad what?
Data.
The Phobos data is from last year, so.
But it doesn't exist, the experiment, for like 2 years. It's just some.
Well, I don't know. So which data is better
star,
data?
Star. Yes. If you show the star, you see that the
error bars.
They have statistics of all counts,
This is statistical error bars. There's very small error bar, but the systematic error bar is not included in that, but it's included in this. That's why the error bar is so large. It's a 90% confidence level systematic error bar, which dominates the whole error.
It's like kind of 100 times smaller than that, and 100 times smaller than
the star data. How big is the error bar?
They don't really give a figure. They don't really give error bars. So there is an issue here because there are these so-called non-flow coefficients, non-flow contributions, which, well, are hard to really access experimentally. So those typically will dominate the systematic error bars. But
then there is some jerkiness which has nothing to do with flow and that should be subtracted, and star in principle haven't done it. But Phobos was such a detector that they didn't even see that. They didn't have even statistics or acceptance.
So what you're saying is that they're not actually reporting V2 as previously defined. They're now
doing
their part of what they see is their part of modeling to remove boring.
It is average of course to 5-0 particles here. Yes?
Right.
And but in principle, so there are these tails which are definitely jets, for example. Mm-hmm. And they have kind of 3% contribution to V2, so you want to subtract it or not want to.
Yeah, but these are just a few percent.
Yeah, it's very small. At least this data, statistically, these guys have a couple billion events.
Yeah, statistically there is no question, but it's about the systematics.
So how many particles do you have to measure one quantity, average of course?
Okay, but somehow I think we got diverted from what was an important point, which is that sensitivity to assumptions about initial conditions completely change your conclusions about what range of viscosities excluded.
Yes, I mean, I should say that, well, so this was just to highlight that this is also fits in seemingly nicely with the integrated V2.
So the whole effect of viscosity is of the order of systematic answer.
Yes. So we are the error are sort of comparable. So this is just what I said.
Both uncertainty is small, it's like 10% of that.
So the
it seemed like the dependence on the initial conditions was a factor of two.
If you want to look at what you get out for a best fit, then I haven't the line on this plot. For the Glaub initial condition, you got about 0.03, and this is about 0.1, so it's even a factor of 3 or so.
In
the best fit value.
Yeah.
It's
not 10%.
No, I'm saying
in eta over S,
it's completely uncertain. I said the quality of the eta over S compared to ideal is of the order of uncertainty.
So what I would take away from this is that at the moment, at least I cannot.
He's unable to reproduce ideal, right?
This is
90% confidence level.
You're
able to reproduce the bound and twice the bound, but not ideal, right?
Yeah, well, so ideal only works to, let's say, 1 GV or so. Yeah.
But you're able to reproduce ideal by changing initial conditions.
Yes, yes, you could do something else than Glauber color
out. Maybe
what he's done so far.
But this plot is slightly misleading. If you reproduce everything up to 1 GV, you already reproduce 90% of the spectrum. And now you speak about some tail.
You don't know a priori where that curve should turn off the hydro.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yes.
That too.
Principally, the positive conclusion can be that with putting in the uncertainties in the initial conditions, you can put an upper limit on eta over S.
So give me a sufficiently pathological initial condition and I produce you any eta over S you want. All I can do is take initial conditions which have some sort of support in the community and play through those two. And basically, this is what I argue I did. There's this Glauber initial conditions, which gives you this result here. And there's this Kolar-Glass-Conin state initial conditions, where up to the fact that it's still sort of preliminary, gives you this sort of three times higher best fit value.
Because I understand it has some rapidity. It has the rapidity dependence.
This is not about rapidity dependence.
It is
this is purely rapidity zero.
You're saying the initial condition will change irrespective of what rapidity you were to start the RP2?
The V2 definitely has a rapidity dependence, which I cannot model in my model because it's a two-dimensional model. I'm only interested at zero rapidity.
I'm asking about the initial conditions. In both models, they would be the same irrespective of the rapidity.
The rapidity demands will probably be different in the two models.
So in other words, one could now do fully 3 plus 1 dimensional viscous hydro.
Then you have more data, you can get better estimates.
It's possible that you see more sensitive.
No, I'm saying even 2D hydro, but with the variety of initial conditions that depend on rapidity.
I don't know.
Compared to that.
Yeah, anyways, I think I'm fairly over time, so let me quickly finish. What my observation is that at the moment I cannot decide whether the Kofton-Sonstarnetz bound is violated or not at RIG, but strangely enough, there is this range of eta over s, which is between 0 and 0.2, which is kind of emerging very solidly from this game here, and not only from what I did, but there's a whole range of other works that have come up with very similar estimates. So I will not go into any details about that because I don't have time. So this already brings me to my summary. I argued that we now have a relativistic theory of fluid dynamics that includes viscous hydrodynamics in the sense that we can put in coefficients both from weakly coupled plasmas or strongly coupled plasmas. They just show up in these coefficients that I displayed. The RIG plasma seems to be close enough to equilibrium that we can at least attempt such a hydrodynamic description. And even though we cannot really decide what if the Kofton-Sonstarnetz bound at RIG is violated or not, there seems to be this range of numbers from 0 to 0.2 for the viscosity of entropy density, which seems to be fairly solid in terms of different approaches. So all I can say, this is work in progress, and well, I think there's lots of work to do, and I would welcome any help from everybody. Thanks a lot.
Is there any way of verifying these initial conditions at least partially independently, so you can then have some confidence?
Maybe. So one thing is, for example, if you would go to fully three-dimensional information, so going to excess data and rapidity dependence of multiplicity, elliptic flow, that would give you more data, so you can constrain better what your initial conditions are. And there's also a nice piece of data, again, by Phobos, who looked at fluctuations of V2 event-by-event fluctuations. So those might also help you to constrain better what type of initial conditions together with which viscosity coefficient are really there at RIG. So you basically have to play through a lot of models trying to model as best as you can data and work your way back and forth between data and theory.
There is some work on this starting from this initial almond, when you go very peripheral, contain not many nucleons, right? It contains less and less, and finally there is nothing left. So it's clear that this whole thing would fluctuate in very strongly. So you can model this longer way how this thing fluctuates. In other words, what is the distribution over this epsilon, right? We don't have access to this epsilon directly, but we have access directly to V2. And V2 has fluctuations. So there are events with fluctuations and Gaussian distribution. Now, if hydra produce a relation between V2 and epsilon, right, the ratio, it turns out that the data of fluctuation of V2 are explained very nicely, assuming that there is longer fluctuation of epsilon and no fluctuation coming from hydra.
I believe this is Phobos, but OK. Albert and Al.
It was another one from
Phobos. It's a different experiment.
So in other words, what the message here is that hydra seems to work on a event-by-event basis, that if you have events with different...
Yeah, but I agree. So there is this data out which may be well suitable to constrain both the initial conditions and viscosity better than what is the case now.
But these explanations are pretty strange because they imply correlation of the fluctuations across the period.
Nobody said a word about rapidity. This is
rapidity zero. This is the model which is employed. I don't know how to explain
it. How V2 at one rapidity relates to V2 at other rapidity is an interesting question that was not done.
Yes.
You asked an interesting question, but that was not.
Well, one thing you can do is run your simulations for LHC.
Yeah.
Do you think it's more testable here?
So what I plan to do is first to get a better handle on both the initial conditions and the value of viscosity at RIC, because otherwise the spread of predictions for LHC is just huge.
So you haven't done it?
I haven't done it yet, no.
What other people did? Just nothing happens, V2 increases 10%, and that is because there are more fraction of time due to QGP relative to later stages.
I'm not aware of
rest to go up at LHD because it's you're accessing higher temperatures and means it's more weakly coupled.
It could be
some range of the time evolution.
We don't know. So
that's my guess.
That you say that you can infer from this that you are close enough to equilibrium is kind of a strong statement. Because you found that almost ideal hydro is rather good, and ideal hydro just needs an equation of state.
You cannot use an equation of state to get a, well, let's say, as good description of the data as viscous hydrodynamics. So equation of state is surprisingly weak in changing the final results of V2, at least.
Yes, and therefore you could also take some equation of state and generate some pressure, some energy density, and that could be far from equilibrium, but rather time independent.
Well, that's in principle possible, but I do hope that, at least with the equation of state is concerned, that lattice QCD has a good, a reliable statement to make on that. And while there are these calculations out there that give you sensible curves, and I think the best at the moment is to use that, because if you say, well, it could be something else, something non-equilibrium, but we don't really know, well.
I'm saying this because it's very difficult to get at one Fermi over C, a thermalized, locally thermalized equation of state.
But to just say the same thing differently, right? Your second point, I mean, you're suddenly bringing the word, you know, close to equilibrium.
Yeah.
All you've really talked about is that a hydrodynamic description seems to give you a reasonable model of RIC data.
Yeah.
Then you sort of, I mean, to make that point, it's as if you're saying, in order for a hydrodynamic description to be valid, you must be very close to equilibrium. That, I think, is the point Jürgen was emphasizing is really overly restrictive. You can imagine a range of out of equilibrium situations where a hydrodynamic description is still good because the stress tensor is still well approximated by the form you used in your hydrodynamic equations.
But you need nearly ideal. You know, if there is a coefficient of gradients, you need not only if it is out of equilibrium. You know, in other words, eta is proportional to mean theta.
Well, but the point is you can easily imagine situations where you have very different relaxation times for different aspects of the distribution of excitations.
Okay, so at least some most important things for the stress tensor relax very quickly.
Right.
Yes. You have to otherwise hydro is not supporting itself.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
There could be some other directions which may be not so.
You had a slide where you said that the first order viscous hydro seems to work at these values of eta.
Yes. That was
so have you calculated the same curves results?
I didn't. This is work by Dusling and Tini, who use a different formulation. So essentially, they regulate the theory by hand, and they.
But couldn't you do it also? I just dropped it. zero of the coefficients?
Yes, I guess this is possible, but I don't think it's much simpler than what I have done, and
it
involves a certain degree of, well, other assumptions. So I don't really see the point.
I'm just curious about the sensitivity of the coefficients of the second order terms.
To what?
That you put. I mean, you use this ADS-CFT.
Yes.
To fix the terms. So
that's what I was trying to
say. The coefficient.
Yes.
You can vary that or put them to zero, even. I mean, use the first order equation.
Well, you cannot put them to zero because I was arguing if you do that, you recover the first order theory and you recover all the instabilities that you had in the theory.
Yes, but I mean, I thought that those guys seem to imply that it works still.
If you regulate it otherwise.
You also have to regulate it somehow.
What about sensitivity to your whole treatment of hadronization? I mean, this Cooper-Frye description is a very, very simple, oversimplified description.
What is it?
Well, it's essentially just phase space. So you take a distribution function, say it's an ideal gas, Bose-Einstein or whatever, and then you integrate over some result surface that you get from a hydrogen.
Yeah, you're saying there's some sharp surface in space-time at which you take your energy density from hydrodynamics and you basically instantly say this is now going to represent some thermal spectrum of known real particles that just fly out.
Yes.
Thereafter.
It's very crude, that's right.
And so there are people who are trying to, you know, glue hydrodynamics to some sort of cascade model.
It's the same thing.
They use
Cooper-Frye to get from hydro to particles, and then they do cascade.
But then particles there.
Yeah, they do, but afterwards, in the middle, they use Cooper-Frye. There's no, I don't know any good alternative.
Because at any given moment, that's the difference. At any given moment, the distribution of particle at thermal.
Well,
the question is how long particle will interact and different types of particle differently. So that is why, that is the whole thing why we did, we and also then Hirano and Miklos went for this whole business of doing this because we knew the different particles result differently. And that's important for radial flow. And it happened to be not important for V2. That's why we switched to V2. Because electricity first builds up and then it stays. Yes? While overall explosion continue to evolve. So these later stages for different types of particles, etc., are important for radial flow, but not for V2. It is also, you know, sensitivity is on the level of percents.
But I guess I want to go back, maybe it's related to this point about the pion data. So you mentioned that you had to put in the Bose-Einstein.
Well, I didn't. That's just the point.
Are you supposed to put that in at the Cooper-Frye?
At the Cooper-Frye.
Right point.
Yes.
Okay.
But that is some overall normalization.
That was the thing I would try to fix.
Goes linearly in all equations. If you just multiply everything by a number, it doesn't make any difference for hydro.
But by the way, hydro doesn't work too well at all, right? For the pion correlation.
HPT?
Yeah, of course.
Do you mean HPT?
So that's completely. I mean, if you look at the other data, then none of the hydro works.
So HPT, I mean, you can argue your way that, well, I haven't done the calculation for this system here, but there are some changes in the HPT data if you use viscous hydrodynamics than ideal hydrodynamics, and at least the ratios of the HPT radii get closer to data, however, at the expense of their absolute values.
Perhaps this is an opportune time to
anticipating that this will be a discussion. May I remind you that we have scheduled another discussion session on this, so maybe we can just do it at turn.
These are details of physics. Forget it; it's not important.
Let's also remind people there was planned